Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our show. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we will be talking in part, certainly to start out, about NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO was created, came into being in 1949. To provide for the common defense of Europe and North America in the event of an attack by the Soviet Union. However, when the Soviet Union ceased to be, many people began to ask questions about NATO. They asked what the mission now of NATO should be, with the Cold War being over. There were some people who even raised the question of whether there was any point in the continued existence of NATO. So in part, here in this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk a little bit about NATO, but we'll also talk specifically about involvement of NATO in Afghanistan, which is, according to our guest for this hour, by far today, NATO's most important mission. Our guest is Bruce Riedel. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution at the Sabin Center there. He is an analyst of the Middle East and South Asian history and politics. He has a lot of experience in regional diplomacy, conflict management, counterterrorism. He retired in 2006 after 30 years service at the CIA, including postings overseas in the Middle East and Europe. He was a senior advisor on the region to the last three presidents of the United States, on the staff of the National Security Council at the White House. He's also served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Near East and South Asia at the Pentagon and a senior advisor at NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in Brussels. He was a member of President Clinton's peace team at Camp David, Y River, and Shepherdstown summits, and he's joining us this morning from Brookings. We have one of those high-quality connections that almost makes it sound like he is here actually in the studio with us, but he is, in fact, in talking to us from Washington, D.C. As we talk, questions, as always, are welcome. People who are listening are certainly welcome to make their contributions to the program. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, please, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, callers are welcome to join the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, people who are listening certainly can be a part of the show. Mr. Riedel, hello.
Hello, it's pleasure to be here today with
Well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time. I am assuming that if I asked you the question today, now that the Cold War is over, is there a reason for the continued existence of NATO? I'm assuming that your answer would be yes. So we'll go on past that, and maybe I'll ask you the question today, again, given the fact that NATO was established during the Cold War and as a defense structure, primarily it's a defense structure against the potential attack from the Soviet Union. Now that there is no more Soviet Union, what purpose does NATO serve?
That's a very important question. My answer to your other question is an emphatic yes. NATO has an important mission to play. Just one moment on the history.
Mm-hmm.
NATO is probably the most successful military alliance in history. It successfully won the Cold War without firing a single shot. And that's a pretty important milestone to keep in mind. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, it has continued to play a very important role in Europe. It has been the stabilizing force in the former Yugoslav states, particularly in Bosnia and in Kosovo, and bringing an end to the truly horrific wars that we saw raging there in the 1990s. And ensuring that there is a measure of peace, stability, reconstruction, and some hope for the future. That mission in Kosovo is not yet finished. But in the post-September 11th world, NATO has even larger responsibilities and larger opportunities. We need some kind of multilateral alliance that can send forces to help stabilize critical situations in areas outside of Europe. And NATO today is engaged in its biggest and most important operation ever outside of Europe, and that's the mission you alluded to earlier in Afghanistan. NATO is fighting its first ever ground war there against a tenacious enemy, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and it is absolutely critical to the survival of the alliance that it succeed.
I am expecting that in the minds of some, the very idea of sending NATO troops outside of Europe would have been, to say the least, would have been controversial. There would have been people who would have argued, said, the purpose from the beginning of NATO, it was about the security of Europe. I think primarily it was about the security of Europe. Yes, North America, but primarily about the security of Europe. Were there indeed people who said that it may be important to be involved in Afghanistan, but that's not the purpose and the mission of NATO?
Well, you're right. There were voices who said those criticisms and said that NATO should be kept very much on a short leash in Europe. But the consensus of the allies, the leaders of the allies, was that NATO did have a responsibility to play outside of its immediate North American and European and Atlantic region, and that you couldn't really bring security to the Atlantic without taking on some of these missions abroad. On the 11th of September 2001, we discovered in America that we could be the target of an attack that was planned and launched from Afghanistan. Our European allies were very quick on that day and the next days to rally behind America, and they invoked Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, which calls upon self-defense in the event any one of the allies is attacked. They supported us then, and now we see ourselves in a situation where their support is very, very critical to winning this battle in Afghanistan.
That, I think, is an interesting point. Obviously, what the important feature of this alliance was that provision that said that all of the members would regard an attack against one of them as an attack on all. And there, obviously, though, at the beginning, the thing the members were thinking about as a potential aggressor was indeed the Soviet Union. So, but that it does not specify that in the treaty. I don't think. At least the significant paragraph here that I have in front of me just talks about an attack against one of them. It doesn't specify who the aggressor would be. So here, obviously, there's enough flexibility to say, well, we were talking about mutual defense. We weren't just talking about mutual defense from the Soviet Union. We were talking about mutual defense full stop, so that it was not particularly then problematic to extend that to an attack by al-Qaeda. It's still an attack. And was there at the time, though, within NATO, were there people saying, well, this wasn't really what we had in mind?
I don't think within the NATO leadership there was any doubt that this is exactly what the organization needed to do. The then Secretary General of NATO, Lord Robertson, from the United Kingdom, was very quick in seeing that the alliance needed to respond quickly to this new world that was created on the 11th of September. And the other allies agreed very quickly that they had a responsibility to assist and to encourage in order to stabilize the situation quickly. You might recall that one of the things NATO did at that time was it used its fleet of airborne warning and control aircraft, AWACS aircraft, to help guard the airspace over the Atlantic, giving our Air Force the capability of bringing back some of our AWACS to be directly over the homeland in order to ensure that we could respond quickly if there was another September 11th type operation where hijacked aircraft were used in suicide attacks upon prominent national installations. So it wasn't simply a rhetorical response we got from NATO in 2001. It was also a practical response. Now that there is continued need for that kind of use of AWACS aircraft in order to monitor important international events and protect international summits and other key events that happen from any threat of a suicide air, as we saw on September 11th. But the alliance has also recognized that if it doesn't play a role in stabilizing hot spots like Afghanistan, then it's really just playing defense all the time. It needs to get outside of Europe and play a larger role. There are those in Europe who have questioned this, but the heads of state of the NATO allies have all unanimously agreed that this is a mission that NATO needs to take on.
We have a couple of callers here, and we'll get right to them just for the benefit of anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. I'd like to introduce again the guest, Bruce Riedel. He's now a senior fellow at the Sabin Center at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He's an analyst of the Middle East and South Asia, its history and politics. He's joining us this morning from there, from Washington, from the offices of Brookings. And we're talking about NATO generally, and also we will talk and have been some, and we'll talk more about the involvement of NATO in Afghanistan, which is what he says is by far the most important NATO mission going today. Questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of people here ready to go. We'll start with a caller in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I know that the Americans did not, when they started the war in Afghanistan, and what they were looking for was Osama bin Laden. And then at some point, our administration decided, no, that was not that important. We need the oil in Iraq. And so off they went to Iraq and got down into this bog of war, and we're still there. And I thought it was very creative shenanigans on the part of our administration to say, gee, let NATO do the job which we started. So I'm kind of curious exactly when NATO put ground troops in Afghanistan. Suddenly nobody talked about Afghanistan and our involvement in it, and our, you know, made statements that as soon as we cleaned it up, we were going to help them rebuild. And, you know, we just left Osama bin Laden and took after the oil in Iraq. So I'm very curious, is one of the reasons why NATO agreed to go into Afghanistan is that for many, many years, the United States was the biggest financial supporter of NATO. So I'd love to hear your comments on my comments and questions.
Well, Mr. Riedel, go ahead.
Certainly. I think your question is a very good one, and I agree with much of what you said. We did go into Afghanistan after September 11th in search of Osama bin Laden and the other al-Qaeda leaders that attacked our country. I think this administration made a major strategic mistake in not finishing that job when it had its opportunity. We should have put enough men and enough money into Afghanistan in 2002, 2003, 2004 to finish the job. Unfortunately, the president chose instead to send American forces to Iraq for a variety of reasons, many of which have proven to be pretty illusory in retrospect. And that had a cost in Afghanistan. We have spent somewhere close to $500 billion so far in Iraq. If we'd spent one-tenth of that in Afghanistan, we'd probably be in a much better situation there than we are now. The NATO allies have been with us in Afghanistan almost from the start. Some of the allies participated in Operation Enduring Freedom from its very inception, although not under a NATO hat. NATO actually put its own flag on the ground in Kabul in 2002, when it took over control of the International Security Assistance Force that was created at the end of Operation Enduring Freedom's first days in order to stabilize and police the city of Kabul. Gradually, over the next several years, NATO spread out from Kabul proper to start covering other provinces of the country, and various NATO allies stepped forward and sent troops to set up what are called provincial reconstruction teams in each of the different provinces of Afghanistan. By the 5th of October last year, NATO had taken over command and control of all of the provincial reconstruction teams in all 25 provinces of Afghanistan and had overall control of the military mission in the country, particularly the stabilization and counterinsurgency mission. partly because of the failure to put enough resources into Afghanistan in 2002 and 2003, we've seen a resurgence of our enemy there. The Taliban organization and its al-Qaeda allies were able to take safe haven in the Pakistan-Afghanistan borderlands, a really tough part of the world. I call them the badlands of Pakistan. In that safe haven, they were able to recover, rebuild, rearm, refund themselves. And last year, we saw them launch a major offensive to try to destabilize the southern provinces of Afghanistan. They were able to launch hundreds of attacks. They used new tactics, which they imported from Iraq, suicide bombings, improvised explosive devices, and really put the situation into doubt for much of the summer and fall of 2006. We know that they plan a similar offensive in 2007, and we need to be ready for it. I'm glad to see that the president, somewhat belatedly, has recognized that we need to put more troops into Afghanistan. And in a major speech earlier this winter, he talked about the need to put more American and more NATO troops in there. It's late in the game to be recognizing the importance, but it's not too late yet, I hope.
Are we still the biggest financial supporter of NATO?
Yes, NATO finances are based upon the size of each country's economy. And since we have the largest economy, we are the biggest financer. But each of the allies provides a significant amount of financial support. It's a complicated formula. We're always trying to get others to pay more. And our diplomats in Brussels have been successful over the years in making sure that there's a pretty equitable distribution of the financial cost.
What is the proportion of troops? How many Americans, English, Polish, et cetera? Not down to the, you know, last number, of course, but I'm just looking for how involved are we in this two-front, where there shouldn't have been a two-front war?
Right. Well, in Afghanistan, NATO now commands about 30,000 troops. Two-thirds of them are from our NATO allies or other players who've contributed forces. There are 37 different countries represented in that NATO force. And if you look at the math, that's even more than there are in members of the NATO alliance, because some allies outside of NATO, like Australia and New Zealand, have also provided troops for Afghanistan. So 30,000 troops total, about two-thirds of them are not American, so about 10,000 American. In Iraq, on the other hand, where there is much less support for the mission, in fact, I don't think there is any significant support at all in most of the world, we have well over 150,000 American troops, and we'll be adding 20,000 more. We do get some support from the British, from the Australians, but very little support overall. NATO has agreed to set up and has set up a small training mission in Iraq in order to help train Iraqi army officers. But there's very little support in Europe or even in Canada for our operation in Iraq, and we're not likely to get a whole lot of support in the future.
I know that one of the things for the Iraqi war and also for the Afghanistan war was using a lot of young people, a lot of National Guards people, and I wonder, what about people, soldiers, American soldiers, who are stationed all over Europe with a big concentration in Germany? Why are they not deployed as seasoned people into Afghanistan, which, as you say, needs way more manpower, women power, than it has right now?
Well, to give this administration credit, it has been reducing the American presence in Europe. The number of American ground forces in Europe has been steadily declining over the course of the last few years. There was a lot of debate in Europe and in this country about the wisdom of doing so, But I think in this case, it was the right thing to do. There's still a pretty sizable presence, and you're right, most of them are in Germany. A lot of those troops do rotate into Iraq or into Afghanistan to do combat duty. So they're not involved. They are very much involved, and they do rotate from their bases in Europe to do 6 to 12 months rotations, sometimes even longer, in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me because we're getting close to our midpoint, and I have now a couple of other callers I'd like to get into the conversation. Others are certainly welcome if you'd like to talk with us and with our guest, Bruce Riddell. He is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. at the Sabin Center there. He's an analyst of the Middle East and South Asian history and politics. He had 30 years service in the CIA, including postings overseas in the Middle East and Europe. He served as a senior advisor on the region to the last three presidents of the United States, on the staff of the National Security Council at the White House. He was also Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Near East and South Asia at the Pentagon and a senior advisor at NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in Brussels. We are here talking about, particularly about NATO in somewhat general terms, but also then we have been talking specifically about NATO and the involvement of NATO in Afghanistan. And as I have mentioned here a couple of times, our guest says that he believes that that is today NATO's most important mission by far, that is Afghanistan. Questions again, welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's go next to a caller in Kankakee. This is line 4. Hello.
Your caller would wish to be educated on a question arising from the charter of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. What specifically in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization charter authorizes NATO to be involved in a military adventure? Before the guest answers, your caller would wish to comment that a clear understanding should be that the major crimes committed on September 11th, 2001 were just that, major crimes. And as major crimes, they call for law enforcement and justice solutions. And your caller would also inquire whether or not the North Atlantic Treaty Organization has been drawn into a private personal military adventure of the head of state of a member nation. Thank you.
Go ahead. Take that on.
The North Atlantic Treaty lays out a process by which the Allies consult with each other when they determine that Article 5 should be invoked. And as we discussed earlier, Article 5 is the self-defense. It says if one member of the alliance is attacked, all the other members will come to its assistance. The way that happens is through a mechanism called the North Atlantic Council. And this is a place where all of the allies are represented at the head of state level. So President Bush represents us, Prime Minister Blair represents the United Kingdom, etc. This meeting of the North Atlantic Council at summit level takes place every other year. When the heads of state are not missing, our ambassadors to NATO meet every week in a forum called the North Atlantic Council meeting. And it's in those meetings that they make decisions on how to proceed in light of different threats to the alliance from around the world. It was one of those meetings in September 2001, called urgently and on a very quick basis, in which the alliance determined that September 11th was an attack upon all of the allies, not just one, and invoked Article 5. As you may recall, the United States and its allies then called upon the government of Afghanistan to do the right thing and turn over the al-Qaeda leadership to an international tribunal, to the United States, to Saudi Arabia, wherever, in order to be prosecuted for their crimes. The Taliban refused to do that. As a consequence, the United States and its allies in Operation Enduring Freedom went into Afghanistan in order to bring them to justice or have justice brought to them. I think that was the right thing to do in 2001 and 2002, and I think this is the right mission to pursue. I would draw a distinction between it and the mission in Iraq, in which we pursued an unnecessary war for reasons which are very complicated and many of which have not proven to stand up to the measure of time. I think it's a mistake, myself, to throw the baby out with the bathwater here. Afghanistan is a legitimate, proper mission in which we have an obligation now to try to stabilize that country and help it recover. Iraq is a completely different one. Whatever you're thinking on Iraq, and I know most Americans now believe this was a mistake, as I do, we shouldn't throw out the Afghan mission in the same bundle with the Iraq mission.
Just very quickly before I go on to other callers, given the fact that among our allies in Europe and elsewhere, over time, support for the U.S. war in Iraq has dwindled. Has that created tensions between, particularly between the government of the United States and our European allies that are in NATO? Has that caused tensions within the alliance? Has the Iraq war actually been bad for the alliance?
Absolutely. The decision to go to war in Iraq tore the alliance apart. The administration, in the run-up to the war in the winter of 2003, asked the alliance for certain things. Many of the allies felt this war was a mistake, the French, the Germans, the Belgians, and others, and were very reluctant to have anything to do with it. It came very close in the minds of some to being really a terminal moment for the alliance. Our diplomats on the scene were able to find some compromises which allowed the alliance to get through that immediate period. It had long-term consequences, though. There's no question that many Europeans feel that this war was a mistake and feel that the United States misused international law in order to justify it. But most Europeans still believe that the mission in Afghanistan was the right thing to do. And I think we see that there is continued support there in order to try and get the Afghan mission accomplished. Just in the last few weeks, for example, three more allies have increased the number of forces they have there: the Czech Republic, Latvia, and Slovakia. Now, they don't have large contingents, they don't have large militaries, but they're making important contributions based upon the size of their militaries to this important mission.
Let's talk with another caller, someone in Spring Bay. That's the next, line number two.
Hello? Good morning. Thanks
yes.
for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I want to make a couple of assertions that I'd like for you to respond to. So I'll assert that this war or adventure in Iraq was a commercial war or colonial war. That's what Zbigniew Brzezinski said in front of the Senate. We're there for oil. Europe has national policies to reduce their use of oil. I think Sweden now has a date certain to be oil-free. Canada is an oil exporter. You can pump oil out of Iraq for $1 a barrel, and so that's the reason we're there, and that NATO maybe doesn't want to go along with that because it's not that big a deal for them. The CIA has been destabilizing governments in Central Asia, funding the Orange Revolution and Red Revolution, various other things going on, all in order to keep control of oil fields. So I'll hang up and listen to your response to that.
All right. Well, you can respond to that any way you like.
Well, I can tell you that I'm still a bit befuddled as to what this administration thought it was doing in Iraq. I think I agree with a key point that you made, and that is that the putative reason, the threat of weapons of mass destruction being used against the United States, was greatly exaggerated, and the intelligence to support that was misused. the president, I think, owes the people of this country in the long term an explanation of what he really thought he was doing there. We haven't heard it so far. We keep hearing the rationale for war change periodically. But I want to come back to NATO for a minute here. There's no question that the decision to go to war hurt the NATO alliance. We have tried since then to try to rebuild confidence between the NATO allies. NATO is now being tested in its first real large mission outside of Europe. If NATO fails there, then I think this alliance probably really will be sent to the dustbin of history. And I think that that would be very, very unfortunate. We know that the 21st century is going to be a time of new international challenges and new international threats. NATO has worked successfully to protect our interests and those of our allies in the democratic world for over half a century. We should make this alliance work, and we should make its work in its test in Afghanistan.
You know, I think, as you say, it has been difficult for people to try to understand the motivations of the administration in going to Iraq. And I think in part it's been difficult to understand because we were given so many different reasons. I think that there are some people, like the two callers that we've heard from, that believe essentially it was all about oil. And I'm sure that everything we do in the Middle East has something to do with oil, so you can't dismiss that. But I wonder whether you believe that it could actually be that among the many reasons, the many and complicated reasons the administration had, was a sincere, perhaps mistaken, but a sincere belief that by installing a friendly regime in Iraq, they could begin to remake the politics of the region in a way that would both promote our vision of democracy and create some governments that would be friendly to the United States, and that would be generally a good thing in the region in part because it would mean, you know, continued access to oil, but also that it would give us a kind of a toehold there and offset something else that the administration is very concerned about, and that is the growing influence of Iran. Do you think that, in fact, the administration could really have believed all of that, that that the long run would be a political outcome that would be satisfactory and desirable to the United States?
I think you're probably right. I think that this administration, and after all, we should remember there are not just one person involved. The president is ultimately responsible, but there are lots of individual players. I think some of them were sincerely concerned about the weapons of mass destruction threat. I think others knew it wasn't that serious and that they were exaggerating it. I think there were some who thought that invasion and occupation of Iraq would be short and quick, and it could lead to a change in the dynamics of the politics of the region and perhaps move it towards more participatory political structures. But I think that there were also many at the time outside the administration, like Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was mentioned earlier, and certainly many among our allies around the world, who stressed two points. One, that the threat was being exaggerated, and two, that the difficulties of occupation were being underestimated. And I think in retrospect, and retrospect's always 20/20 hindsight, but I think in retrospect, on both counts, the dissenters were right. The threat was much exaggerated, and the difficulties of trying to transform a Muslim country in the heart of the Middle East, like Iraq, into some kind of Western-modeled democracy were much, much underestimated. Therefore, in my judgment, this was a strategic mistake of really monumental proportions. One of the other side drawbacks of it was it distracted attention from the real threat, and that threat is the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization and the Taliban movement, which has hosted it. And because we were distracted from that threat and we didn't fund and man the war effort against it appropriately, we've seen that threat recover and actually be resurrected. And that's a real serious strategic downside for the United States of this war in Iraq.
So if, again, I have some callers here, if they will just forgive me for asking one further question at that point. We're now at the point where we're likely to see fighting in Afghanistan and start up again. We're coming to the end of the winter, which is there is severe enough so that basically everybody just hunkers down for the winter. But we're coming into spring, and I think that there is the every expectation that there will be a significant offensive on both sides. What do you think here in over the next couple of months we're likely to look forward to, or, well, no, to be hearing about in Afghanistan?
I think what we're going to see is, as the snow melts in the Hindu Kush, a step up in operations by the Taliban forces. And they will focus their attacks on several provinces in southern Afghanistan, Helmand, Kandahar in particular. These are the provinces where the Taliban began in the mid-1990s and where they've always had their strongest local support. The forces that are immediately on the front line there are British, Canadian, and Dutch forces, with assistance from other allies as well, but primarily British, Canadian, and Dutch. They're going to face a very serious opponent. I think what we're going to see is a stepped-up wave of suicide attacks, of attacks by improvised explosive devices against convoys and the like, and even in some cases fairly large Taliban forces trying to take over police stations and small towns in these provinces. Last year, they even made an attempt at one point to take over one of the provincial capitals. They were defeated in that. I think you're going to see some very sharp fighting. British Army commanders in Afghanistan have said that last year's fighting between them and the Taliban was the toughest conventional fighting that the British Army had seen since the Korean War in 1953. And since the British Army's been involved in a lot of conflicts since 1953, I think that gives you a pretty good measure of just how tough some of this conflict is going to be.
Can we hope to succeed in Afghanistan if indeed our measure of success is to defeat the Taliban and do what we can to go after whatever al-Qaeda are still in this region? Can we hope to do that without greater cooperation from Pakistan, which so far has not really been forthcoming to the extent that we would hope for?
You're absolutely right. Pakistan plays a critical part in this. As I noted earlier, it provided the safe haven where the Taliban and al-Qaeda were able to regroup after Operation Enduring Freedom began. Pakistan has a very complicated relationship with terrorist organizations. Over the years, it has sponsored some of them, particularly the Kashmiri groups. It's also sponsored the Taliban. It is true as well, though, that since 2001, more senior al-Qaeda operatives have been caught in Pakistan than anywhere else. So it's a complicated situation. Pakistan pursues what I call selective counterterrorism. They go after some terrorists and terrorist groups, but not all. As a consequence, they've allowed a milieu to continue to exist in which some of these terrorist organizations can operate. The United States and its NATO partners need to be very clear with Pakistan that its time for half measures is over. We need to take a very serious move against all terrorists operating in Pakistan, starting first and foremost with the Taliban. But let me say one other thing as well. Even with the cooperation of Pakistan and with military success on the ground in Afghanistan, we're going to need one other element. And I think NATO's leadership is very much aware of this. We're going to need a massive economic reconstruction program. NATO Secretary General Jaap de Hoop Scheffer has frequently said that this war cannot be won purely by military means. It needs a major Marshall Plan-like economic reconstruction program for the country. Afghanistan was one of the poorest countries in the world 30 years ago when the Soviet Union invaded. Since then, it's seen 3 decades of war. Its infrastructure has been badly damaged. It needs all the help the international community can get. President Bush, earlier this month, wisely increased the number of American troops in Afghanistan. Again, I thought it was late, but better late than never. And he promised more military assistance for Afghanistan to build its own army, which someday will replace the NATO forces. What was missing was a commitment to a major economic reconstruction program. We shouldn't do it all ourselves. We should ask our European partners to participate with us. We should ask Japan to participate with us. We should ask the Arab Gulf states, who have an interest in seeing al-Qaeda defeated, participate with us. And I think we should ask the Russians to play a part in this. I'd like to see the administration exercise international leadership in trying to build such a major economic reconstruction program. I think if you have these 3 pieces, the military, the economic, and the diplomatic, working effectively, we can still win this war in Afghanistan.
Has someone put a price tag on the, particularly the economic part of that?
I think you can find any number of estimates, but I think a long-term commitment, something in the order of $20 billion over 10 years, is probably what you need.
We have a number of other callers. Just very quickly, I'll introduce again our guest, Bruce Riedel. He is a senior fellow in the Sabin Center at the Brookings Institute Institution in Washington, D.C. He's an analyst of the Middle East and South Asia. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hello. You've spoken about the need for greater cooperation from Pakistan. And it seems to me that's going to be very, very difficult for the Pakistani government. Several times over the last couple of years, I've seen figures to the effect that, well, the last I saw were in The Guardian, and the poll indicated, I think, something like 80% of Pakistanis admired Osama bin Laden as a great hero. And about the same number absolutely refused to believe he had anything to do with the events of September 11th. In fact, they generally lean toward the conspiracy theory that it might have been the Israelis or the administration itself. I'm not a believer in conspiracy theory. I don't think the administration in particular has the competence to have pulled anything of the sort off. But that's beside the point. The point is that in the Islamic world, we've managed to turn Osama bin Laden into a hero. We had great sympathy after September 11th, but that's pretty well dissipated. And it appears to me there's real danger if we try to press the Musharraf government into more of a crackdown on al-Qaeda and the Taliban, that it could simply disintegrate, and we'd have complete anarchy in Pakistan. And that would be anarchy with a fairly sizable nuclear arsenal.
Hmm. Well, Mr. Riedel, you want to comment on that?
Well, you're absolutely right. The stakes here are very, very big. We're talking one of the most difficult and complicated countries to deal with in the world. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. It has a history of proliferating its nuclear technology to other countries, North Korea, Iran. And it has a long and intimate relationship with various terrorist groups. You're also absolutely right. We face a very mad and angry Muslim world. I was in the Persian Gulf last month and spoke to a lot of friends I've known for a long time, and I've never seen people as mad at the United States as I saw there. We got ourselves into this mess by squandering that goodwill that we had in the aftermath of September 11th, and it's going to take us a long time to get out of this mess. But I don't agree with the proposition that we shouldn't put more pressure on the Musharraf government. In the long run, it is in Pakistan's own interest to bring these terrorist groups under control and to bring terrorists like Osama bin Laden to justice. They've killed far more Muslims than they've killed Americans in their terrorist operations. And the danger they pose to the Muslim world in the long run is more serious, I think, than the danger they pose to us. What we should do in Pakistan, I think, is work to see a restoration of democracy and civilian rule. General Musharraf took power in a military coup of almost a decade ago. It is time to have Pakistan have free and fair parliamentary elections as they're scheduled to do this year, and to see a restoration, perhaps gradual, but nonetheless an important restoration of democratic rule and civilian rule in Pakistan. I think if the army goes back to the barracks, that will help in the process of building popular support for doing the right thing on the terrorist front.
We have just about 5 minutes left. I want to thank the last caller, and again to go on to get at least one more. The next in line in Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I share the caller from our caller from Kankakee's kind of bemusement at the fact that a defensive alliance can be faulted for not going beyond playing defense in your language. You've been very careful in some of what you've said. I mean, you were talking about NATO leaders supporting the mission in Afghanistan. Italian support in the population is down to 70% for pulling out right now. 80% if you count just the supporters of the ruling coalition right now. And we know that actually was part of what brought down the government just recently. So we're not just talking about unstable Pakistan here. And one thing that you didn't weren't careful to say about, and it is a commonplace, it gets repeated over and over, that the Afghanis, the Taliban at the time, would not turn bin Laden over to anyone. That's just not true. They were willing to try to negotiate a release to some other party. Now, whether that would have been fruitful or not was apparently not something that the U.S. wanted to look into, because it really wanted to get its warlords on and turn the Northern Alliance loose. I actually wanted to originally talk about real NATO issues. I don't think they should be there. But when your question about Germany and how many troops are there, it was our former ambassador to NATO, Rumsfeld, he was an ambassador then during Nixon's time, who transferred troops from Germany into Poland, which also goes against the pledge of not surrounding and not pushing NATO into the de-blocking Eastern Bloc. Beyond that, there's also the idea that Kosovo illustrates that NATO thinks it can operate outside of the UN. Obviously, there would have been an impasse with Russia, but I think arguably one could make a view of anyway. Obviously, that's too much to dispose of in a few minutes, so I will listen for what you do try to reply to. Thank you.
All right. Yes, and we are at the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. You can deal with whatever that you feel that you'd like to.
Well, you raised many provocative issues. Let me just say one thing. Before September 11th, the United States sought from the United Nations 5 Security Council resolutions pressing the Taliban to turn over Osama bin Laden. That's before September 11th. It started in the Clinton administration and continued in the Bush administration. The Taliban refused all 5 of them. I think it was pretty clear to everyone that the Taliban was not going to do what it needed to do about Osama bin Laden. It nurtured this Al-Qaeda terrorist group, and it hosted it for a very long period of time. I don't see really a case can be made that giving the Taliban more time in 2001 would have produced the necessary results. I think we did what we needed to do then. My big concern is that we haven't funded the mission since then, and that we've let this mission deteriorate over time so that we face the very real danger that in addition to losing the war in Iraq, we could lose the war in Afghanistan as well.
Let us see then if we can get at least one more. We'll go to Urbana Line 2. Hello.
Hi. Quick question about Iran. My question is, what, short of an outright attack by Iran on the United States, would justify the U.S. taking military action against Iran?
Well, in my view, we shouldn't take military action against Iran. We have our hands full right now. We don't need a third war in the Middle East. Our military is already stretched very thin. I think that we should continue the process of using diplomacy with regard to Iran. We succeeded in getting a UN Security Council resolution late last year condemning Iran for continuing to pursue nuclear weapons development. I think we're going to get another resolution shortly that puts some small sanctions on Iran. Those sanctions may be small, but I think over time they will sharpen the debate in Tehran about the wisdom of pursuing a nuclear weapons policy. I think using force right now would be a strategic catastrophe, both for Iran and for the United States. Among one of the immediate casualties would be the collapse of the al-Maliki government in Baghdad, which couldn't survive the crossfire between its two closest allies, the United States and Iran. So I think the wise course here is to pursue diplomacy, and I hope the president means it when he says that is what he intends to do.
We will stop there. We must, because we've come to the end of the time. We want to say thanks to our guest, Bruce Riedel. He's a senior fellow at the Sabin Center at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Mr. Riedel, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And also our thanks to engineer Ed Berkey there at Brookings.